I'm not going to do anything with you. Not if you mean by that, do something to you without your leave. We might do some things together. I don't know about sides. I go my own way, but your way may go along with mine for a while. That's a Treebeard quote from the Two Towers.
Welcome back to Bookwave, the Book Club podcast. I'm your host, Scott, joined today by Pat,
Yeah.
Will,
Hello.
and Jason.
By root and twig, I'm glad to be here with you, friends.
Beautiful. Today we're looking at book three of The Lord of the Rings, otherwise known as the first half of The Two Towers. And if you're new around here, you should check us out at our website at bookwave.club. We're on YouTube, Anchor. But my first question is, how long did it take us to read the first half of this book?
Man, like, what are we, 4 months since we did the Fellowship of the Ring now, I think?
Was that the Fellowship, or was that when we did The Hobbit? I'm not sure now.
It might have been Fellowship.
Maybe.
It feels like as much time as the entire cast of Lord of the Rings spend walking is how long we've been reading this book. Like, if I had a head, maybe a king of eagles to help me with this journey and expedite my trip, I think I would have been quite grateful.
See, books like this, I actually love getting into and reading over the course of a week. So I read through book three in like 4 days.
Wow.
Yeah, it was around the same time for me, maybe a little bit longer.
Like
Let me ask you
breaking it
this,
up.
though.
I'm sorry, Will. I was just gonna say breaking it up like kind of makes the illusion disappear a bit. So I like to just keep it all together at once and really delve into it.
So, did you read this book in 4 days right after the last recording of the Fellowship of the Ring? Or was there a mountain of procrastination that prevented you from opening the book? And then once you started, it was right away.
Yeah, kind of the latter. I procrastinated quite a bit getting into this one.
Right. Like, I feel like it's like when we read The Wave, like I lapped that up like some warm milk in minutes, and
Yeah.
we recorded it within a week of ordering it. It was like it was done and dusted because it was so small and so easily consumed. But with The Lord of the Rings, like, I've got these ornate book bindings, and I know it's a big, hard book to read. And so for me, it was like, oh, I don't have time to read that. I don't have time to read that. I don't have time to read that. And then all of a sudden, it was like, oh, I haven't been reading that, and too much time has gone by. And now, non-negotiably, this is happening.
I had a very similar experience because like I woke up every day and we're reading the Bible at the same time as reading Lord of the Rings. So I was like, what seems easier? Well, neither one. We're looking at Job or Lord of the Rings. These are both huge. I'm not going to make any like real progress, any like seeable progress by just reading a few pages, which is all I really have the energy for. And then I just kept mounting and mounting and mounting, like, oh, it's been a month and I've got one chapter of Lord of the Rings and I haven't touched Job. This isn't good.
See, for
Well, and it's
me, it
like,
took me a long time to actually get into reading it for, hours on end. I just started off just reading a few pages at a time and then going back to whatever book I was focusing on to begin with, and other jobs. But eventually, I think what kicked it in was just the hook of everything going on in the story, like with Pippin and Merry, and being held captive, and eventually meeting Treebeard, and then eventually, going with Boromir's death and everything like that. It's just, I guess it was just getting back into the interest of where the Fellowship is now, where they're going, and what obstacles they're going to overtake.
so if if you don't know this, we got this recommendation from Paul Vanderclay, right? Like we had our interview with Paul and we're like, oh, we're reading the Bible. And he's like, oh, that's great. Well, if you're reading the Bible, you should check out The Lord of the Rings. And I think we foolishly were like, oh, book recommendation. Okay. And now it's like, oh, almost a Bible recommendation, but mythologically built and fantasy. So we're like, we're reading the Bible. You know, it would be neat if we read two Bibles at the same time.
Yep.
Well, so in this book three, have you guys found similarities to the Bible? Because they haven't really shown themselves or revealed themselves to me.
So here, let me... Here's the comparison. They're the same size. Like, when I'm watching Smallville and I love it because Superman's great. But it's like when you do something as big as the Lord of the Rings or 10 series, 22 episodes per series season run, you have more than one character's arc, right? Like the hero's journey is happening to one of the characters, but then, you know, there's a redemption arc and there's a destruction arc and you get to flesh out more than just this one story. Like when you look at The Wave, one thing happened and here's the story of how that happened. But with The Lord of the Rings and with the Bible, you've got so much more. And with like what Tolkien did is he created a world with history and mythology and references, and he created this highly referential text that's referring to the appendices and the Silmarillion and these ancient battles. Like I've spent hours on Lord of the Rings Wikipedias just finding out about Feanor and the Glittering Caves and all of these things that he fleshed out because he felt that that was what was important, was that you had not just a world, but a world history, and not just a world history, but a cultural history, and not just a cultural history, but 15 cultural histories and languages and interactions. And it's not biblical in that it's the word of God being given to Frodo, but certainly there is gods involved, and there is an interesting philosophical notion that happens, you know. And so that's where I see the similarities, is that there's just so much depth that you can create so many metaphors and parallels to this book. And you can think about, you know, is it worth doing something even though the end may be dark?
Yeah, I think he provides for a lot of people what, you know, what we look for in religion. Like all of like the story and mythology is a lot bigger part of it than I think we all realize. So like when they're going over the history of the Palantir and all of these stones, my brain goes straight to Marvel with the Infinity Stones, right? But then like when you look deeper into it, you got that idea from the Vikings and their mythology and the sagas and the Eddas. So, you know, I guess he just like keeps these ideas alive in a way that you can't really get from just the old stories. Like the Bible and the Eddas and the sagas are great, but Tolkien kind of revitalized them and modernized them, and that's what I think Marvel does a lot in DC when they attempt to recreate this mythology.
I often find myself asking the question, like, what is his inspiration and motivation behind writing this great saga, this epic? And I kind of get the feeling that what he was trying to do was provide some kind of justification for why the world is the way it is after having just emerged from World War II. You know, he's trying to ask the question, well, where does evil come from? And how can we keep hope in the face of darkness?
See, the way I figured out about the Palantir was the distinction between knowledge and wisdom and how they can be incorporated by good and evil. Like when, let's see here. When, you know, when Gandalf discovers that Saruman owns a Appalatir and how he's able to communicate with other parties around Middle-earth, it's almost like I just pictured it as like not exactly a map or anything like that, but just the way that everyone communicates on a network and everything. And how far it spreads and what is being discovered and how it eventually affects people. Like, especially with when Gandalf breaks Saruman's power to free, and I'm totally going to forget his name, the king.
Theoden.
Theoden, yeah. It just shows how one can be so in control with, you know, this negative energy from whatever information they've gathered and just let it consume them entirely to the point where they don't even know themselves. I don't know what you all think about that.
It got major Tower of Babel vibes from what you just said. Like, with the idea of the Palantir being, like, the only means of communication to, like, other civilizations between, like, the bosses or whoever's up at the top of the tower. It's like, that's like a post-Tower of Babel thing. Like, they still have the tower at Isengard. Like, Orthanc is still there, but, like, it's everybody is spread out. Like, the elves have their own kingdom, the dwarves have their own kingdom. God's people spread themselves among the earth just like he wanted them to. And then the Palantir was what kept like the seven stones or however many stones, I'm not sure how many there was, but that's what, like, that was the only form of unity that they had. Like, their culture and everything's completely different. And maybe he got that idea from the Tower of Babel. Just like, all you need is just a little crystal ball for your prime minister and the next guy's president.
Well, it's interesting, the convenience of that sort of form of communication and what that sort of opens up for individuals, right? Like, with Saruman, you know, theoretically, he took possession of Orthanc, he found the Palantir, and he withheld that information from the Council of Wizards. And then Sauron got his own Palantir, and he started working his own magics on it and compelling Saruman to come report to him. And it's like, we have now today technology that allows us to communicate with our friends whenever we want. Cell phones. When we didn't have that, you know, it would be weird if you went and hung out with an individual 7 days a week to have a conversation about absolutely nothing. And, like, if you look at the basic dichotomy of a relationship, where if your partner went outside of the home to go have a conversation with another prospective partner every day of the week, you'd say, what are you doing? Like, your time could either be spent with me or them, and you're choosing them. But now, the convenience of communicating with 50 people about trivial information, you can do that all day, and you don't think about the impact because it's not really going somewhere and being able and having to commute to go do that whole conversation thing. And people are constantly upset about the fact that they don't have the energy to respond, or they don't have the energy to hang out when they're asked to hang out. And it's like, we're dealing with the detriments and the positives of a technology that allows us to feel like we're not responsive enough, when in fact it's not that we're not responsive enough. We have a technology that enables us to be way more communicative, and that's not necessarily part of the human experience. Like, it's not necessary.
That's like,
the weird thing is, we have all the time in the world going on these devices. That's what we just, you know, we keep that to ourselves. We don't say about it.
Yeah, like, it's wild to think that Tolkien made one of Sauron's greatest weapons, a seven-way walkie-talkie. and five of them are lost. And every single one of us today have a cell phone in our pocket, way more powerful than Sauron's seven-way walkie-talkie with five of the walkie-talkies lost. And
well, it's like, imagine if I told you that I could give you a device that would allow you to bear witness to a negative outcome about the future, and how would that affect you? It's like, well, we've got a billion stories and movies about what happens when we focus on a negative outcome. We get a negative outcome. And no one even bats an eyelid to think that, you know, social media and everything that everyone has to say isn't something that needs to be consumed on a daily basis.
But in some cases, if you don't see the horrible outcome, there's nothing anyone can do to fix it. Like, if no one ever heard of Sauron until he came to your kingdom and squashed you, then no one was ever going to defeat him. Like, you need to be able to gaze into the darkness at least a little bit to be able to actually do something against it.
Right. And I think in the book, the Palantirs allow you to have vision of far away, but I don't think they allow communication of sound and voice, right?
Well, so they're a little bit different from... Like, Sauron asks Pippin a question.
Yeah, he says, "Who are you?"
Because he's got the head Palantir that was in Osgiliath in the Stardome, and so it had a bit more power than the Palantir that Sauron had. But he was effectively able to communicate his thoughts and see the thoughts of the person who was holding the other Palantirs.
Okay, that makes sense. But I'm thinking, like, in our day-to-day lives, we have these cell phones, which are like, walkie-talkies with video capabilities. And I'm thinking, you know, it makes us connected, but how often are we surrounded by a council of people in real life, you know, that can interact with us, give us a hug and watch over us in a way? Because at the beginning of this book, we see Boromir being found after the battle with the orcs, after Merry and Pippin have been taken. And, you know, he's like on death's bed, basically up against a tree. And his friends, Gimli and Aragorn and Legolas, they build a raft and put him down the river. They do a good thing, you know, but it made me think of my own mortality. Like, if I were to die, who around me would be there to do that and take care of my bones? And that was, it really like touched me pretty deeply there.
Yeah. I mean, the other option could be, you know, Earth can take you. Nature, you know, Mother Nature can take you down with her or anything like that. But yeah, I totally get what you mean by that.
Evil can take us too, because that's what the orcs were. They're corrupted versions of nature. That wasn't nature themselves. That was the army of darkness.
Yeah, I think they're supposed to be like corrupted versions of the elves, right?
Right. Yeah, I wrote down that part too when the Ents were talking to Merry and Pippin, telling them how the trolls, like, oh, you've heard of trolls before? You've seen them lumbering statues? They're corrupted versions of us. And the orcs are just corrupted versions of elves. So, yeah.
Well, and then, so, sort of returning to that voice inside your head, like, if you look at Boromir, right, he grew up in Minas Tirith on the gates of hell, basically, right? Like, you wake up in the morning, you go on your balcony, boom, there's Mordor, and it's burning, and it's smoky, and it's terrifying. And you've got this father figure who's saying, this is going to kill us all. We need all of the power in the world to keep this danger at bay. And he comes to the council in the first book wanting the ring, right? Like, he's been told that there's this existential emergency in his life that he has to deal with, and he needs to get this power. And he's suffering from this anxiety of wanting to use the ring to be a good man. And he's stuck in this sort of ubermensch mentality that he thinks that if he can acquire power, he can do good. And he loses himself. He loses his own morals and he sacrifices his means to try and acquire this thing. But then when the real emergency hits, everything that he believes about reality goes right out the door, because our morals and our ethics in an emergency, when orcs are literally attacking you, it all changes. And he's like, oh no, I'm gonna give my life to save these hobbits because that's the only thing that makes sense to do right now.
Yeah.
And sort of all of that illusion that his father, was it Denethor, gives him, they just all fall off the table. The minute orcs strike, he can be a good man. But until there's a real crisis, he's stuck being anxious, trying to consider ways to resolve what he perceives as a crisis and emergency, but it isn't. And it's interesting because it's not, I don't know.
Yeah, and that connects back to our conversation we had on like the last Lord of the Rings book, where we're like, if the ring represents evil, you can't use it for good. Like, Sith lightning is dark side power. Good doesn't come of that. You can't kill someone for good, like, without getting corrupted by it yourself. But
yeah,
like in the, I had kind of a revelation when I was reading like the stuff about the corruption of the elves becoming orcs and the trolls, or the Ents becoming trolls. It's like in both of those cases, they can't be caught out in the sunlight. Like the orcs get all burnt up and hurt, and the trolls turn to stone. So what I thought was, is it really the sunlight that's doing it, or is it the fact that they are confronted by their shadow? Like, their shadow doesn't exist at night when there's no light, but as soon as the sun comes up and they're forced to face that Jungian shadow that sits right in front of them, it's too much for them to handle. All of their corruption gets thrown right in front of their face. Then they just have a mental shutdown. That's what I thought. Like, same thing could apply with like vampires and any other corrupted supernatural creature that can't get caught out in the sunlight. It's not the fact that the sunlight is toxic to them. It's that it exposes them for who they are, and that destroys them from the inside out. That's my theory, anyway.
It's almost like when they turn away from, you know, the light, and they take upon themselves, you know, these evil existences, everything that should have been good for them can no longer sustain them. You know, like when you go to bed at the end of the day and you're buffeted by anxieties and worries and you're going over all these things, they don't happen in the daytime because that's not the time for them. And when you have a healthy, active life that's well adjusted to normal cyclical patterns of human society, where you're out in the world, you know, hunting and gathering and sowing the fruits of your labor, you don't have those concerns. It's only when we stop at night, when we're forced to pause, that we start to ponder these things, unless, you know, we have a good system of journaling and therapy. But when you turn away entirely from that system, then it doesn't, you can't even get the benefits of it. And there's no point in a troll being out during the day, because it's just, that's not who they are anymore. And it's like they've surrendered their own ability to become something of good. Like, they've identified with their darkness, and so they reject anything that doesn't get them closer to what they have decided is their way of life, because there's a secondary gain to being a troll, isn't there?
They switch between worlds, essentially.
Yeah, it's like...
But there's something different in this book, because Saruman is like... created this new race of orcs, the Isengarders, the Uruk-hai. Yeah. And they don't seem to have a problem working and toiling in the sunlight, right?
Indeed.
So, like, were they, like, just cooked up by Saruman out of the dust and dirt, or were they corrupted men? Because that might be saying a lot about, you know, the human race, that, like, we're able to delude ourselves so much that being confronted by the shadow, we can just ignore it. That's the superpower of man. The elves and the Ents, they were way too noble to ignore any, like, destruction they were doing to the earth. Men, we don't care.
It's the superpower of a charismatic and convincing and powerful leader, right? Like, so now they don't have to think. And they've been mutated enough that they can believe in Saruman and they can do the thing because Saruman's told them that this is going to be the best way forward. And I think that we're all kind of looking to deceive ourselves and follow a leader. And we, to a certain degree, will sacrifice our own morals if it allows us to not have to think too hard. I think that's probably the concern, right? Like, if you get someone in charge who is believable enough that can convince a body of people that if you just agree with what I have to say, we'll get there. Don't worry about your own thoughts. Just force people to get vaccinated and it'll all work out. Yeah. Then we lose ourselves and we lose the entire point of what we're fighting for.
Right.
Yeah, that reminds me of something Aragorn said to Theoden, I believe. He said, you know, when the great fall, the less must lead. And I know he meant it in a different way, but if you take it in an interpersonal perspective, if your highest self, if you allow that to fall, your lower self or your shadow is going to fill in that vacuum.
Wow.
Did you guys have any favorite chapters in part three?
I really liked it when the Fellowship or Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas make it to Isengard and they're like, what's going to happen now? We're in for the fight of our lives. And it's just Merry and Pippin and we get the entire recounting of the Entwar. Like, after the fact, I thought that was great.
Yeah, that was a really good scene. I think, for me, every chapter was really interesting because it had almost no relationship to the movie.
Yeah.
It's similar enough and different enough that it was a new experience, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
Didn't the movie start off with Sam and Frodo? And this one, like, that's pushed off to part four, right?
Yeah, that's what, like, I really picked up on, like, George R. R. Martin's writing style. Like, I see where his influence comes from Tolkien, because when you're reading, like, A Song of Ice and Fire, it's every chapter is the name of one of the characters. Like, chapter one is Bran, chapter two is, like, John or whatever, and then it just keeps going, and you keep getting to, like, the next Bran chapter, and, like, everything progresses from a different character's perspective. So, like, in this one, it's the first half is Merry and Pippin, and the second half is Sam and Frodo. So, it, like, they split up the two hobbits, or the two sets of hobbits. Like, you get the young pair, then we'll get the older ones in the second half kind of thing. And then we fill in all the holes. And that's something that, after reading a handful of George R. R. Martin books, I know that that's what he does a lot.
So Brian Jacques, which is the author of the Redwall Abbey series and a few other books, but there's tons of young adult Redwall Abbey books that I read from Brian Jacques. And it was the same thing where it's like, they've got two or three characters and the world is unfolding in all of their experiences. But like, you read one chapter and you're really interested, and then the next chapter is something completely unrelated almost. And it's not till later in the book that they all merge. And you love the merging, but man, don't you want to know what that guy is up to in his next chapter? And I remember wishing I could skip forward, but knowing that that would defeat the whole point.
That was the thing about this, though. Like, when I was reading it, like, okay, I know what he's doing. I get it. If I just skipped it, it would ruin the experience, because, you know. But yeah.
I couldn't believe that there was no grate on the culvert for Helm's Deep. Like, that the entire crux of the Battle of Helm's Deep in the movies just didn't exist like that.
Yeah, well, it's gotta be, like, cinematic to a point, right? Some things work really well as a book, but, like, that chapter that I described about, like, oh, they make it to Isengard, and then it's just, oh, fake out, the war's already over. That wouldn't work in the movie at all. You have to be able to see the flood and the trees marching.
And that was another thing too, right? Like Saruman doesn't harness the energy of a dam in the books, and the Ents don't destroy said dam in the books. Like, there's so much about the Ents that is just wildly and inappropriately different in the movies than in the books. Like in the movies, Treebeard gets together with the Ents and they hold a meeting and they say, you know, we're not going to go to war. Sorry. Doesn't matter to us. And Pippin's like, okay, well, let's just take a shortcut this way to get home. And then he sees that the forest has been destroyed, and then he goes to war. In the books, Pippin's like, hey, so Saruman's kind of like destroying stuff, and Treebeard's like, yeah, I know, we should kill him now.
Yeah, well, here's my argument for changing everything. Another argument for changing everything for the movie. If you really wanted it to be exactly what you got from the book, then just read the book. You already have the book. If you're going to make the movie, it might as well be something different. If you want it to just be the exact same story, you already have that story. What's the point? Just to make it look good and CGI?
Yes.
Film and books are entirely two different mediums.
Yeah, well, like, so we have the same argument in, like, the comic book, you know, fandom, let's say. It's like, oh, why is He Who Remains this guy instead of this guy? Why are the timekeepers all fake robots? It wasn't like that in the comics. Well, you have the comics. Just go there. if you want to watch it. If you want to read it, read it. The medium's the message. It's all up to you.
Yeah, I kind of feel the videos and movies are meant to be digested, you know, in a shorter period of time, whereas I find a lot of joy, you know, reading these books and pondering about the topics, you know, where you might get that. You might get goosebumps during the movie, but there's really something euphoric about sitting down, reading something and mm-hmm. finding connections to your life and to the world at large.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, I do understand, you know, that you can do different storytelling when you do a different medium. But I think that there's no need to completely change the plot and mix and match the story how you'd like. Like, I think that this story could have been told the way it was written on the cinema. And it could have been really cool. But for some reason, Peter Jackson said, no, we're actually going to make an entire army of elves show up to save Helm's Deep that just don't exist in the books. And you know, he takes a lot of creative liberties. And for me, I have a hard time understanding why that was necessary, because there's a lot of cool stuff that happens in the book that, like, you could cut out, because you could capture that by just showing someone's facial expression. Like, you don't need the details that are removed, that aren't, like, there's easier ways to express them when you have literal actors and arenas and symbolism. But to completely change the way the plot progresses, I don't understand the need for that. And it doesn't upset me. It confuses me, because for me, I get two different tellings of the Lord of the Rings. There's the Lord of the Rings I grew up on the screen, and now I get the books that I'm exposing myself to. But I wouldn't have been upset if I read this book and it read like the movie.
Well, that's when you have to implement what we comic fans call a headcanon. Because if you've ever read more than one, say, Captain America comic, he's real hot right now. If you know that, like, every writer writes Captain America as a different character. Like, yeah, it's always Steve Rogers. It's always the same character. But, like, every writer is going to put themselves behind that character, whether it's, you know, Stan Lee or Ta-Nehisi Coates, right? So, like, you just have to kind of choose, like, which ones, like, which stories mean anything to you, which ones don't. I'm sure a lot of you guys here and a lot of people listening can guess which Captain America books I prefer over the others, but like, there's also another adaptation for Lord of the Rings. Like, have you ever seen the animated movies? They're like really short and like super faithful to the book, I've heard.
So, a long time ago I saw that.
Yeah, they're made in like the 70s and 80s, I think.
Yeah.
Like really old school animation. I've only seen like bits and pieces of them, but like I don't remember that from the movies that I've seen.
Right.
It puts all the songs in too. Like you don't get any of the hokey little songs like "I'm Tom Bombadillo." That didn't happen in the movie, but like it does in the little animated one, because like the animated medium makes a lot more sense. It's like, oh, it's for kids, even though there's murder and war, but it's cartoons, they're kids. So let's put in some hokey little music, and that's what everybody will remember us for. But like, that's another decision. If you're going to adapt it, you have to like, are we going to try to implement Tolkien's vision, which we don't really know what it was. We just have his writings. We don't know his real opinion of what he would want it to look like on the big screen. We just have, you know, the people involved in the project as they're making it, and like the decisions that they have to make. Are they going to try to make it for a modern audience or just the hardcore Tolkien heads? Are they going to try to like spice it up with a little bit more like action that never really happened in the books? Or are we just going to try to be faithful to what we think Tolkien would have wanted? We have no idea. What if he was still around and like he was like George Lucas being like, I want AT-STs walking around in the background and stormtroopers marching in every scene.
Yeah. That's the thing too. Like once it's been created, it sort of leaves its creator. And
yeah,
the more you try as a creator to control the interpretation of your artwork, like it's absurd, because you can make a piece of art that, like, you know, I saw this one post on the internet of this person who was doing a piece of art for The Great Gatsby, and they had him reaching out, but he didn't have hands, and the English teacher was like, oh, you know, he can't reach, whatever it is, and the guy's like, I just couldn't draw hands.
I can relate.
But it's like, that's the thing, like, it's not about what you tried to make the point of your piece. It's art resonates with people for different reasons. Symbolism has an effect on our brain, and we perceive stuff that we relate to in ourselves. And the point isn't to make a piece of artwork that makes the world a better place. The point is to make a piece of artwork, and that makes the world a better place.
Right. And then we could just talk about J.K. Rowling and how she keeps changing all of her characters and adding in little backstories that conflict with everything. And oh, by the way, you need to know all the sexualities of each and every character in my universe, so get ready for that. Like,
congratulations, I'm triggered.
Like, you're not going to make anybody happy with that kind of nonsense. Like
you don't tell me that the snake that Harry released from the first movie is Voldemort's snake posthumously.
Yeah.
You know, like, you wrote the book, it's published, it's on a dead tree. You don't get to tell me about stuff now. It's over. I don't want to hear it.
So before I start talking about comics, what else about the book?
There were a lot of really good quotes in this book, in part three. There was one I found that was kind of related to The Mandalorian. I don't know if you caught that, Scott, where the head of the Ordukai, Ugluk, he's like, I am Ugluk, I have spoken.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember hearing that.
I have spoken.
This is the way.
Sorry, Pat, go ahead.
I was going to say, that one scene where when Pippin remembers his spare pipe and he gives it to Gimli as like a gift. I don't know what
Was
you
that
all
like
think about that.
touching to you?
Well, I mean, it just goes to show how, how far these characters can, provide such gratitude to each other, even though they are completely different people. And the pipe is kind of like, it's the one thing that hobbits love to do. They like to smoke some really good weed and
And
everything.
eat some good food.
Eat some good food and everything, and just offering that to an entirely different race. That's very touching.
Yeah, it's like,
What
let's share our
better?
culture with each other.
Yeah.
But it makes me think of the Odyssey when they're doing the sport and they're like, okay, well, now it's dinner time, and what better activity to engage in than a fine meal at the hour of dining? And it's like, what better a gift to receive than a pipe at a moment in time when that's what you need?
Yeah. What better gift than a pipe when you have a barrel of tobacco?
Yeah,
Yeah, but that
and
kind of
it's
that keys into like the relationship between all of them, like Legolas and Gimli particularly, because like they're supposed to hate each other. Their cult, like elf culture is dwarves are dumb. Dwarf culture is elves are hoity-toity and holier than thou. And like it does not take long for them to become like inseparable, the best of friends.
Yeah.
In a way, the hobbits in this book, Merry and Pippin, I found to be kind of the heroes
Oh, yeah.
by bringing people together, by Aragorn and the crew like going and looking for them and everything that happened. I thought they were the heroes.
Yeah. I mean,
Well,
it could have been some really badass elves, but Merry and Pippin.
it's like yesterday we're moving and we had just gotten back to the location we had to unload at, and my dad and I had brought the truck and my wife had got there first, and so she had had a little break, and so she starts unpacking and we were gonna have a break, but there's this tiny little human who's still working, and it's like, okay, well, we can't not work. Like, if you're working, we'll have to band together to work together so that we can all take a break later. And these hobbits come into the scene and they're like, well, like in The Hobbit, literally, like I'm gonna help you get your home back. And the dwarves are like, wow, like you're amazing. And then in this book, they're like, well, I've got it. I have the ring, so, and it needs to be destroyed. So I guess I'll do it so that my friends can continue to live their life the way they want to. And then dwarves, elves, and man all band together. Like, if this tiny little halfling is going to make a difference, how can we sit idly by?
Yeah, I just picture like a chubby, short hobbit just hopping off his seat thinking, "Oh, no one else is gonna do it. Better get to work."
Yeah, and it's like you've got a choice in every single event that you experience. You can either be the person that does the thing or the person that doesn't do the thing. You can be the person that does it with grace or with destruction. And the hobbits are these wonderful little creatures that, at least the ones that we're exposed to, always choose to do good.
At the appropriate time, because there's time for second breakfast and third lunch and everything else.
Which ties in nicely with the quote I have from Aragorn. The Council of Gandalf was not founded on foreknowledge of safety for himself or for others. There are some things that it is better to begin than to refuse, even though the end may be dark. I think
Yeah.
that's a really good one.
What stuck out to you the most for that one?
I think too often we shy away from doing the right thing because it's hard, or because it's going to be temporarily difficult, or because we are looking at the choice without the context of our existence. If you remember that this decision you make today will affect you tomorrow and next year and 10 years from now, it changes how you feel about it, But if you're sitting there in your bed at 7 in the morning, hitting snooze because you think, well, I have time to do it. then you're missing the whole thing, where it's like, no, this is every day, this is every morning. And if you don't get up early today, you're not going to get up early tomorrow, because the choice you make in this moment is most likely going to be the choice you make in the next, unless something happens in the moments in between.
And I guess that's what happened to Frodo. I mean, he just kept hitting the snooze button when he knew he had the ring, but he didn't do anything about it until, you know, what was it, 13 years later?
And just, well, exactly.
I would argue that's what King Theoden did, or right, allowed happen to him. Just, he stayed in the fog, you know, so long.
Yeah.
And that's the problem we have when we're, I think the word is chrysalism, when you're stuck in your own home in the midst of a storm and the safety and comfort you experience of being surrounded by your amenities. It's like, unless there's a tiger at your door, or you can mentally conceive of some way to get that fire under yourself, it's very hard to do anything. Like, we're mammals, you know, like we want to sleep all the time and eat berries. But
that like ties into, sorry, go ahead.
Like, we can't just sleep all the time and eat berries, especially when a bear shows up and wants to fight us. But most societies don't have many bears knocking down their doors. You know, it's not every day you get a call saying, we've stolen your child and you need $50,000 to give us for a ransom. But how many of us, if we got that call, would be able to muster up $50,000? We'd probably all do everything we could, breaking all of our moral codes to try and get that money. But it'd be much better to prepare beforehand and take preventative action to become the highest versions of ourselves, so that we don't have to delve down to the lowest depths of our humanity to get what we need to do that's non-negotiable in the moment.
And I, that makes me think a lot about who I think is the, like, the slimiest character in this section, Wormtongue. And his biggest crime was essentially saying, hey, there, snooze button's right here, just press it. Going to the king every day, snooze button's right here, just press it. So I think there's a lesson to be learned in that too, where, like, not only do we have to be vigilant for ourselves, but, like, don't be that snooze button for other people. When you see people just going through the motions, hitting the snooze button, be like, hey, man, there's four other buttons on that alarm clock. You're still running on daylight savings. What's going on here? Get your stuff together here.
Yeah, he's enabling, and he's also benefiting from the enabling, of course. Because there's always a benefit to enabling someone else. Because if I can convince you that you don't need to work hard today, then it is a lot easier to convince myself that I don't need to either.
Yeah, but I think that benefit that he receives is a lot more costly than it is beneficial, because he's literally putting himself in the pocket of a big evil wizard and infiltrating as a spy in a house full of, you know, people that will kill you. He was very lucky that they didn't.
Well, exactly. I think you'll find that's pretty much every instance of any sort of peer pressure. If you've ever been to a party where you didn't want to drink as heavily as everybody else was, and they pressured you into having another drink or taking another shot, then you know what it's like to have a mob think that what they're doing is okay, and anybody who doesn't conform get crucified.
It's like that scene in Dante's Inferno where they're all trying to crawl out of the boiling cauldron, and they're just pulling each other back in. Like, mm-hmm. No one can get out because they're just pulling. So Wormtongue would be the person at, like, the bottom of the pit. He's in complete chaos and just under the thumb of the wizard and scared for his life because he's right beside the king who he has made his enemy. And he's just like, no, you come back down here. You come back down here. My life is going to be miserable. So is the rest of yours. I think that's the worst kind of character you can become.
When you deceive yourself to the point that you think that you can get what you want by negative means, like, the person that gets what you want needs to deserve it, because otherwise it won't even be worth it.
And to kind of round this conversation out, that reminds me of, you know, the question, you know, what's the song of your life, or what's the song of your day? Like, so Wormtongue's song is going to be most likely, you know, depressive and ugly compared to the song that Aragorn and Legolas sung for Boromir.
Yeah.
Well, I'm pretty excited about part four of this, getting into Smeagol and back to Frodo and Sam. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
There was one other thing that I should have said while we were talking about the adaptation in the movie, but one of my favorite scenes from the movie is in this section of the book, when Gimli and Legolas are counting each other's shots and like, 42, you beat me by one, my old friend, but I won't hold it against you. Like, that part was really wholesome. I always remember that part from the movie. That and like Orlando Bloom just down the stairway.
Yeah, gamifying awful existential threat and just competing and being in a flow state where it's like, oh, if they stopped for a minute, they'd be like, oh my goodness, there's 10,000 things out there trying to kill us. But no, they're just like, I'm going to get more than you.
Yeah.
Does that have anything to do with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy being the answer 42 and the question being, well, how hard are you trying?
I did think about Hitchhiker's Guide when he said 42 there, but like, I'm pretty sure Douglas Adams has come out and said, no, that number was just random, I just made it up, it was the first thing that came to mind, 42. It's just like, oh, what's an arbitrary number, 42, that's the answer. It was like this shadow work that we're doing, Will, like, he just let his subconscious answer. Like, what's the answer, 42? Oh, shit.
First answer, best answer.
Right. And then our minds just generate the questions. We can't help it.
Yeah. Well, it's not the first time Hitchhiker's Guide has come up today. And I was talking about that with a client earlier, but I was saying to Scott the other day too, like, if the author of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy had any clue or sentiment to the fact that the Book of Job had 42 verses and that that was what he was referring to, that would be a pretty good answer to the ultimate question. Because let me tell you, the 42 verses of the Book of Job, that's an interesting story right there.
Yeah, well, no question there, but you'll have to check out our next episode of the Book Wave to find out more about that one. So, do we have anything more to add?
No. No, I'm looking forward to the next. Like, comment, too. Subscribe, give us all your money.
Yeah, donate on Anchor. What you think. Yeah. May the force be with
Until
you.
Until next time. Or equal to mass times acceleration.
Poof, poof.
Have a great one.